So let me start by thanking the organizers for putting this together. These conferences I've been to previous versions, always very stimulating, and it's always great to come back to PI. So I have a confession to make. The title I promised is different from the one I'm going to talk about. Now, what I promised to talk about, we were hoping to get all our confusions sorted out before this morning, but unfortunately, we only got more confused by this morning, so I don't feel ready to talk about whatever I promised. So some of you might have heard this talk before, I apologize. So the work that I'm going to talk about was done with this wonderful postdoc at MIT, Jen B. And it's on the archive. Crucial encouragement and a lot of advice from Max Metlitsky. You know, Max is right next to me at MIT, and talking to Max for half an hour once in a few weeks, you know, clears up the entire several weeks of confusion. It's really amazing to have such a colleague. And a very crucial conversation, a brief but crucial conversation with Nati Seiberg when he was visiting us last fall. Okay. So this will be a talk about quantum criticality in condensed matter and in field theory. And textbooks have been written on quantum criticality by someone in the room. But despite that, what Subir will definitely tell you and what many of us feel is that our intuition for what kinds of continuous quantum phase sensations are possible and how to describe them is very poor. And the textbook example involves a phase transition from a completely trivial phase of matter to a phase of matter that's completely characterized by a Landau order parameter. And then there's a good theory of framework to describe such a phase transition, and it's just a quantum Landau-Ginzburg-Wilson theory described in terms of a fluctuating order parameter field. Now, there's many other cases in which that standard paradigm fails for well-known reasons. There's a simple reason why it might fail. It may be that one of the two phases is not, the phase itself is not describable within the Landau order parameter paradigm. And then, of course, the phase transition is bound to be beyond this fluctuating Landau order parameter, right? There's nothing, for instance, fractional quantum Hall transitions, nobody would ever expect them to be describable in terms of order parameter fluctuations. More surprising, perhaps, is that it's known that you can have phase transitions, continuous phase transitions between two phases, each one of which is Landau allowed, but the phase transition within Landau theory is forbidden. But that phase transition, this Landau forbidden phase transition, nevertheless, may turn out to be a continuous one, and there are examples of this kind in quantum magnetism. So the best studied example is in a 2D square lattice antiferromagnet that's been halves per site, going between the nail ordered state and this sort of state that preserves spin rotation symmetry but breaks lattice symmetries. It's known as the valence bond solid. This has been studied for many years. And at least if you generalize to SUN spins and take N big enough, it's known with complete confidence that the transition is second order, though it's forbidden by Landau's thinking. For SU2 spins, there's a lot of numerical work over the years indicating that the transition may be second order, but it's not completely settled yet. Now, at that kind of phase transition, it's what's known as a deconfined quantum critical point. What happens is that the field theory that describes that kind of Landau forbidden phase transition is most simply expressed in terms of deconfined degrees of freedom that rear their head just at the quantum critical point, but get confined into conventional excitations on either side of the phase transition. So this is exactly the story for this nail to valence bond solid transition in square lattice antiferromagnets. And there are by now many other proposed examples of this phenomenon in 2+1 dimensions. In the last few years, it's become clear that the theories that describe this kind of phase transition often also emerge as descriptions of phase transitions between trivial and symmetry-protected topological faces in 2+1 dimensions. And the relation, and the reason why the same sorts of theories emerge in both situations, we now understand quite well, it's that the relationship is explained by the understanding of dualities of 2+1 dimensional field theories that has been developed in the last few years. So if you don't know this, the statements about dualities in 2+1D, I'm not going to use them in this talk or explain them, so you can just ignore the statement, okay? So what I'm going to talk about instead of phenomena in 3+1 dimensions, primarily, in fact, entirely. So I'm going to focus on a number of quantum critical phenomena that, at least to me, were very surprising when we first stumbled upon them. So the first example that I'm going to talk about is of deconfined quantum criticality in 3-space dimensions, of which previously we didn't have any example. And it turns out this example of deconfined criticality is much simpler than the 2+1D examples, in that the IR physics is completely known, and we don't need the power of detailed numerical calculations to decide what's going on. So another phenomenon that shows up once we start thinking about this is something that many of us had pondered about for a long time in the field, and it's the following question. Suppose you have a phase boundary between two faces, phase A and phase B. And let's say everywhere on the phase boundary, the transition is second order. Is the entire phase boundary described by the same universality class? Or could there be multiple universality classes depending on where you cross the phase boundary? Okay? It's of course known that you could have things like fixed lines where exponents change continuously and so on. But here what we're envisaging is that there's one kind of second order phase transition controlled by one fixed point along, say, this entire region, and another kind of second order phase transition controlled by a different fixed point along that other region. Okay? So this is something we had pondered about, and till recently we didn't have any examples in clean systems. There are examples known in random spin glass type systems. Sorry?
Is it example in 1D?
I don't know of an example in 1D, but if you can think of something, it would be good to know. There's fixed lines, of course, right? But not something where there's two different fixed points. Now, a third phenomenon that we came across is what we call an unnecessary quantum critical point or unnecessary continuous phase transition. Here, what happens is the following. If you take, when one first starts learning about phase transitions, we learn about the liquid-gas transition, which occurs within the same phase. It's a first-order transition that occurs within the same phase. And this first-order line ends at a critical point. You can go around it. Right? So what we'll find here is that within this a single phase of matter, there's a second-order line that you hit. So it doesn't separate two phases. It just, by tuning one parameter within a single phase, you end up at a critical point. And that phase boundary ends at some endpoint, and you can go around it smoothly. Okay? So there's no reason for this critical point to exist in the sense of it doesn't separate two phases, but it does. Right? Yet another phenomenon that we'll find quite routinely, in fact, is that if you think about phase transitions between band insulators, things that are describable within free fermion theory, there's certain kinds of phase transitions that are allowed and certain kinds that are not allowed. For instance, if you think about integer quantum Hall phase transitions, it's well known that within free fermion theory, that the Hall conductance can only jump by one at a continuous phase transition. There's a rule like that in free fermion theory. The question is whether with interactions, the same rule is true, even though the phases on both sides of the transition are describable within band theory. Okay, so we'll find that those kinds of rules, you could have band theory forbidden quantum criticality between two phases that individually are described by band theory. Okay, so as an outgrowth of all this fooling around with phase transitions, as a bonus, we'll conjecture a striking possible duality of fermions in 3 plus 1 dimensions. I should emphasize right away that this is it's a conjecture with some amount of evidence and support, but it's hardly strongly supported. It looks promising. All right, so I'm going to focus on theories in 3 plus 1D, and I'm going to start by talking about a very simple theory in which I can illustrate all the methods that we're going to use. Hopefully everyone will understand this part of the story, right? It's just a free Dirac fermion. Now, most of the talk will not be about free fermions. It'll in fact be about more complicated theories. We'll instead talk about SU2 Yang-Mills theory with matter fields, and we'll show how to interpret these as deconfined quantum critical points, discuss some generalizations. And then in the end, depending on time, I'll talk about this possible duality in 3 plus 1D, where we'll show that a theory that is described as a gauge theory and is strongly coupled has some chance of being dual to a free theory augmented with a gapped topological quantum field theory. Now, a very similar duality of this sort was described last 2 years back by work by these three people, one of whom is a PI faculty member, that it's a lower dimensional example of something that has a very similar structure. Okay, so let's start with this free Dirac fermion in 3 plus 1 dimensions. So this is the Lagrangian. So psi is a four-component fermion, and I've only written down the kinetic term for the Dirac fermion. I'm also going to allow adding to this kinetic term a mass term, psi bar psi, and that mass term is what we'll tune to drive the phase transition. Okay? And as a probe of this theory, the free Dirac fermion has several global symmetries. In particular, there's a charge conservation. So as a probe of that charge current, I'm going to allow myself to couple the theory to a background gauge field, capital A. It's just a probe. Are there any string theorists in the room? Oh, Tawid, yeah. So just for you, this A is actually going to be a spin-c connection. I've learned to protect myself by making that statement every time there are string theorists in the room, or if I'm talking in public, like at PI. It's actually useful as a bookkeeping device to keep track of the fact that all fields with odd electric charge are fermions and ones with even electric charge are bosons. Okay, and I'm also going to allow myself as a probe of the theory to place the theory on an arbitrary space, smooth oriented space-time manifold with some metric G. Right? This will enable keeping track of some response of the theory, like thermal transport, things of that sort. So this theory has this global U1 symmetry, and it also has various discrete symmetries. The symmetries I'm going to focus on is time reversal, and I'm going to choose time reversal in such a way that the electric charge of the U1 is odd under time reversal. So this is not the standard choice. It's what field theorists call CT symmetry, but that's the symmetry that I'm going to focus on, because it will enable me to seamlessly connect to the other parts of the talk. Okay, I could also have made the most standard choice for this example, but it's useful to make this choice because it connects to other things that I'm that the generalization that I'm going to make. Okay, so as we change the sign of mass of the fermion, there is a phase transition from one phase to, from one massive phase to another massive phase. And right at m equals zero, there's gapless excitations, of course. Right? Now, a key property is that one sign of the mass of the fermion, for one sign of the mass of the fermion, if I regarded the system as describing a trivial insulator of these fermions, then the other sign of the mass of the fermion should be described as a topological insulator of these fermions. Now, kinetic matter physicists usually think about this as a band inversion transition. I learned this from Tim's PhD thesis. I learned band theory quite late in life, but Here we'll only need the field theory description of this understanding of the distinction between the two signs of mass. There's a very physical way to think about this distinction between these two faces. Let's imagine setting a spatial domain wall where m changes sign, right? On the left, m is positive, on the right, m is negative. Then we solve the Dirac equation in the presence of the spatial domain wall. It's a standard exercise. And what you then find is that right at the domain wall, there's a massless two-component Dirac formula, okay? Which, of course, is the well-known signature of the of a topological insulator surface state. So it tells you that the two faces, if one of them is trivial, the other should be regarded as a topological insulator. So that's the physical understanding. Now, this physical understanding is very good, but to generalize to the more complicated examples, it's useful to have a more formal understanding of the same result. And the formal understanding will come from deriving the change in the theta term in response to these background gauge fields as I change the sign of m. Okay? So again, as all condensed matter physicists know, topological insulator has a theta term at theta equals pi for a probe electromagnetic gauge field. So if we can show that these two signs of m, the partition function, differs by a theta term at theta equals pi, then we establish the result that one side is topological while the other side is trivial. Okay? So let me briefly sketch this formal derivation. It's very simple. So the partition function or the free Dirac fermion of mass m is some fermion determinant. It's just the determinant of the Dirac operator plus the mass. And the Dirac operator is anti-Hermitian. So minus I times d is Hermitian. So its eigenvalues are real. So we can express the determinant as a product over the eigenvalues of the Dirac operator. Now, the massless Dirac operator d anti-commutes with the gamma 5 matrix, right? Which means that this anti-commutation means that all non-zero eigenvalues come in pairs for each lambda I. There's a minus lambda I. So the ratio of partition functions, which is something like this, in this ratio, it's easy to check that all non-zero eigenvalues cancel out, and the only things that you're left with are zero modes, is the contribution from zero modes of the Dirac operator. Okay? Now, zero modes do not need to come in pairs, and so they don't need to cancel out. Right? So the ratio of these two partition functions is minus one. You know, for each zero mode, I get a contribution of minus one. It's minus one to the total number of zero modes of the Dirac operator. Now, zero modes of the Dirac operator, you can organize it according to its helicity, the gamma 5 eigenvalue. It can either be plus one or minus one. And the total number of zero modes is the sum of the positive and negative helicity zero modes. But minus one to that number is the same as minus one to the difference between the number of positive and negative helicity zero modes. And that number is a topological invariant known as the index of the Dirac operator. So we establish that the ratio of the partition functions is minus one to the j, where j is a topological invariant. Okay? Now, it's known that this topological invariant has a nice expression as the integral of some local quantity by this theorem. And in particular, this j is simply related to this integral of E dot B with some coefficient and a similar term involving the metric. And if you plug this into here, you get exactly the right theta equals pi response to the topological insulator. Okay? So this is the formal proof that if one side is trivial, the other side is a topological insulator. Okay? So the key calculation that underlies the entire story I'm going to tell you is to not worry about partition functions themselves, but to worry about ratios of partition functions for two different signs of the mass of some Dirac fermion. So let me comment on this massless point. So the massless Dirac theory, it's well known that it has more symmetries than the massive Dirac theory. For instance, there's two Weyl fermions, and the number of Weyl fermions is separately conserved, right, of each Weyl fermion. So we can do a chiral rotation of two Weyl fermions. From the point of view of this talk, as indeed is natural in condensed matter physics, we'll regard these symmetries as emergent, the extra symmetries of the master's point is emergent. And these emergent symmetries are anomalous. For instance, there's chiral symmetry, it's well known that there's a chiral anomaly. There's more general anomalies associated with this masterless point. They are what field theorists call the toothed anomalies. So we'll deal with them as necessary. But they our point of view is that they are emergent symmetries, not fundamental symmetries. Now we can generalize this to n-free Dirac fermions, which is the same as 2n-free Mariner fermions. The global symmetry is SO2n cross T. And the story works out in exactly the same way. If you take the m less than zero theory to be trivial, then the m greater than zero theory has a calculable theta term for a background gauge field that couples to SO2n and the metric G. So the interpretation of this theory at its massless point is that it's associated with the quantum criticality of a trivial to topological phase transition of fermions with this global symmetry. Okay, so that's the simple example. So now I want to think about SU2 gauge theory with matter. In fact, I want to think right at the beginning about only the simplest such field theories, things that are there in every field theory textbook. You know, it's field theory, maybe not 101, but the first non-abelian gauge theory that you might encounter. So I want to think about theories with NF flavors of fermionic matter fields. And I want to separate out two distinct cases, one in which the matter fields are in the fundamental representation, and the other in which they are in the adjoint representation. Right? Now, oftentimes, these are discussed together if you're doing perturbative or G and so on, system size of some representation. But we'll see that these are, in fact, very different theories and should be interpreted as completely different beasts. Okay, so let's start with the SU2 gauge theory with fundamental matter. So these psi fermions are the fundamental of SU2, and this A is an SU2 gauge field. Now, the first comment about this theory, which is obvious to, I think, condensed matter physicists and probably to a lot of high energy physicists, is that though there are fermion fields occurring in the Lagrangian, this is really a theory of bosons. Okay? So the point is that all local operators in the theory, all the baryons and mesons, are all bosons, and there's no local operator that's a fermion. So it doesn't matter what you write in the Lagrangian, it's a question of what the statistics of the local operators is. So this is a theory of bosons, and with NF flavors, you can it's easy to see the theory has some global symmetry, which is this group SPNF mod Z2 times time reversal. Okay? So the point of view, we're going to view this theory as the IR description of some UV system of interacting gauge invariant bosons with this global symmetry. Right? So the point of view is that the fundamental entities in the theory are the hadrons, right? And at intermediate scale, there may be a description in terms of these fields. Okay? At intermediate lower energy scales. And then there's a third question of what happens in the deep IR, whether the hadrons re-emerge or whether these quarks stay deconfined. But at the UV scale, we'll just regard this as a theory of bosons. Okay? So when the fermions are massless, this theory, it's a standard theory from textbooks, so we know a lot about its properties. So the number of flavors is large enough, the theory is not asymptotically free, and it flows in the IR to a free theory, the gauge coupling flows to zero. For NF smaller than a critical value, if NF is small enough, the theory is believed to be confining. And it goes to symmetry broken phase or something. And at intermediate NF, that's believed to be a conformal window where the theory flows to a non-trivial CFT. Now, this is known quite exactly from perturbative RG. There's a lot of controversy on exactly where this sits. So I'm going to keep things simple in this talk and talk about this regime where NF is so big that the theory is IR-free, right? So then, so usually that's dismissed in the high energy literature as boring, but we'll see that that's where things really come alive from a condensed matter point of view. Okay? So the question I want to ask is what kind of criticality do these theories describe? You know, there are some gapless theories after all in some system of bosons, right? So what is the critical point? So let's think about the RG flow structure for large NF. So G is the Yang-Mills coupling. It flows to zero because an F is large at the massless point. But if you perturb away by turning on a bare mass to the fermions, so then down to some scale, the coupling constant will go down, the Yang-Mills coupling will go down. But once the system realizes the fermions are massive, then at scales lower than the fermion mass, you can forget about the fact that there's any matter at all. You map to a pure SU2 gauge theory, which of course flows to strong coupling, right? And gets confined. So the RG flow has this structure. It's a familiar structure from the theory of the deconfined critical point, where things are, this is what we call a dangerously irrelevant coupling. Things flow down initially and then flow back up to strong coupling. So this massless weakly coupled fixed point separates two strongly coupled faces, okay? So that makes it interesting, right? So the question then is, what's the nature of the two massive faces? Now for M less than zero, we can take it, like in the previous discussion, to be a trivial symmetric gap face, okay? Now for M greater than zero, what happens depends on the induced effective action for the SU2 gauge field. And the induced effective action, it turns out, has a theta term for the dynamical SU2 gauge field at theta equals nf times pi. Now, if nf is odd, the theory is very interesting. It's an SU2 gauge theory at theta equals pi. David has recently written beautiful papers on this subject. But we don't really know what happens at strong coupling for this theory. Since the goal is to keep things simple, I'm going to stick to NF even, where you don't get any theta term for the SU2 gauge field. Get standard pure SU2 gauge theory in the massive phase. And the theory confines, it's believed to confine, and go into a trivial gap state, completely trivial, right? It's completely trivial, but it could be in a different SPT phase from the M less than zero theory. Okay, so the question is, is there a difference? Okay, but already we see that the massless point is deconfined, though both phases are confined and are trivial, you know, in terms of the trivial short-range entangled symmetry-preserving states. Okay, so this is an example, a solvable example of a deconfined critical point in 3+1 dimensions. So the way in which one does the calculation is perhaps not important since I probably don't have time, but you can calculate this theta term for the background global symmetry. And indeed, there is a non-trivial theta term for the background global symmetry here, on assuming there's none here. So if this is a trivial boson phase, then where it flows to here is an SPT phase of these bosons. So the interpretation of this IR-free theory is that it's a deconfined quantum critical point that is separating a trivial phase of bosons from an SPT phase of bosons with this global symmetry in 3+1 dimensions. Okay? So this is an example then of a topological phase transition of bosons in 3+1D, which is also a non-trivial deconfined quantum critical point. Of course, this theory has emergent free fermions and blah, blah, blah. So now let's generalize this. This is the basic story. Let's start generalizing this. You might think this is a bit esoteric, but it turns out to be easy to do. And it'll reveal an interesting phenomena, right? So we're going to generalize this to SP and C gauge theories. Why not, right? We're just fooling around anyway. there's no experiments in this talk. So if you generalize to SP and C gauge theories with NF fundamental fermions, the one interesting observation is that it turns out that the global symmetry, there's also a bosonic theory, and furthermore, the global symmetry of the boson is the same independent of the value of NC. So this is as good a theory that could emerge from some underlying boson system with that symmetry as the SU2 gauge theory is, right? But by studying this class of theories, it turns out that we can easily generate a large number of IR distinct phase transitions between the same two trivial and SPT phases of bosons which each correspond to different values of n, you know, this may correspond to one value of nc and this to some other value of nc, okay? And they are free, so it's more master's degrees of freedom here than here, and they're locally stable. You only need to tune one parameter to hit that part of the phase boundary. So this gives us very simply examples, in fact, an infinite number of examples of this phenomenon where the same phase transition admits multiple universality classes. It admittedly esoteric, but concrete.
So the universal data is parameterized by the value of nc?
For instance, yeah.
Isn't that what happens with ordinary phase transitions when you crank up the number of fermions or bosons as well?
Like, no, then the physical degrees of freedom have changed. Right? Here it's the same physical degrees of freedom, but the number of emergent degrees of freedom is what's changed. Right? Okay.
So, question. So if we look at correlation functions of local operators, there's no distinction.
Oh, you can look at something like a heat capacity, it'll be totally different. Yeah, thermodynamics is totally different, right? The A coefficient is different.
How do you see the structure from?
Oh, you had to calculate these theta terms for the, you know, the global symmetry is the same, right? And it's a system of bosons, right? Independent of NC. But then you had to calculate the theta term for the positive sign of mass. And the real point is that infinite number of values of NC are allowed, but the number of distinct theta terms for SPT phases is only a small finite number. So sooner or later, you're going to end up with multiple universality classes for the same phase transition.
So these two different phase boundaries that describe different values of NC?
Exactly, yeah. That's basically the idea, yeah. Now that's the statement. All right. So fooling around even further, one finds this phenomenon of an unnecessary quantum critical point that I mentioned earlier. So for instance, if you take NF and NC both to be equal to 0 mod 4 and NF big enough, right? So the theory is IR free. So then you calculate the theta term for the background global symmetry, you find that there is no theta term, right? For if you make this particular choice. That means that both the phases for both signs of mass are really the same phase, right? But the critical point is stable, right? So you have a quantum critical point living within a single phase of matter, and both sides in this example are theories of bosons which are completely trivial, short-range entangled, they have a gap, there's not even SPT order, nothing, right? But then you tune one parameter, you end up here, and this along this along that phase boundary, there are emergent free fermions. Right? So it's totally bizarre from any condensed matter point of view. So this isn't some esoteric example. Now it turns out there's a much simpler example of the same phenomenon in a context that may be slightly more familiar in condensed matter physics. If you take 16 copies of helium-3b, you know, helium-3b is class D3 topological superconductor, fermions with T squared equals minus one. So it turns out this phenomenon already occurs in this system. There's no gauge fields, nothing here, right? So with n Mariner fermions, as we already saw, when you change the sign of mass, you go from a superconductor, a trivial phase of matter to a topological free fermion phase of matter. Now it's known that if n is 16, then time reversal alone does not distinguish the two phases once you have interactions. Right? This is known for a few years now. Now if you keep the full SO16 symmetry, then you ensure that all these 16 Mariner fermions change mass at the same time. But then if you keep the full SO16, then the SO16 distinguishes these two phases from each other, even though time reversal doesn't, right? So then, that doesn't quite qualify as an example of the phenomenon that we are seeking. But it turns out that if you only keep SO2 cross SO7 symmetry, right? So then there's no Mariner mass term that's allowed at the massless point. At the same time, with SO2, just this symmetry, there's no symmetry distinction, there's no SPT distinction between these two phases. Okay, so I don't have time to describe that argument. It's actually quite simple and makes use of methods that Chong invented when he was a graduate student. So this gives us an example in a much simpler system of this phenomenon of an unnecessary quantum critical point. We also have examples in 2 plus 1D which also don't involve gauge fields and so on. So it may be more common than we had imagined before. Okay, so now let me go back to the gauge theory and talk about theories where instead of fundamental fermions, I have adjoint fermionic matter. Okay, so Lagrangian looks the same as before, except that the psi transforms in the spin 1 representation of SU2. Okay, now in contrast with the theory with fundamental fermions, this theory should be viewed as a theory with local fermion fields. The point is that a combination like this, using the epsilon symbol, is a gauge invariant fermion. And so this theory, in this theory, there are color singlets which are gauge invariant and which have Fermi statistics. So I should really view this as emerging in a system of microscopic fermions. Now it turns out that to enable that interpretation, I have to modify this theory by including heavy bosonic fields that transform in the fundamental of SU2. Okay, for reasons that I'll mention in the next slide, and it's related to papers that Davide has written. So the global symmetry of this theory is SO2NF cross time reversal with the fermion field, the gauge invariant fermion, transforming the vector representation of SO2NF. So we view this gauge theory, the point of view we are going to take is similar to the previous portion of the talk. We'll view this gauge theory as the IR description of some UV system of fermions with this global symmetry, okay? Okay, now if the mass M is zero, then it's known that the conformal window with adjoint matter occurs at lower NF than with fundamental matter, which is good, right? The theories become much more closely connected to things we know and love in condensed matter physics. And in particular, asymptotic freedom is lost for NF bigger than or equal to 3. So if you're thinking about SO6 fermions or something, then it's a reasonable theory. Now, if I don't add the spectator fundamental scalars, then the theory has unbreakable electric strings that transform in the spin half representation of SU2. Okay? Now any theory that has these unbreakable strings, right, has basic degrees of freedom, cannot emerge from a lattice condensed matter system with some tensor product Hilbert space structure, because then you don't have loops, right? Such loops. So this thing has to be, these loops have to be broken to enable the interpretation as a lattice fermion system. So that's why we add these heavy fundamental scalars. So there's a nice way of characterizing the theory without these fundamental scalars. The fact that there are these unbreakable strings is what Davide has characterized as a one-form symmetry, a Z2 one-form symmetry in this case. And we'll have to keep track of the symmetry as a low-energy emergent symmetry of this theory as when we discuss it. Now, the story at large NF is actually very similar to the story before, so I'm not going to belabor it. There's one subtle point which is perhaps important to pay attention to. Precisely which SPT you get, it turns out it depends on how symmetry is realized on the spectator bosons. So in a fundamental sense, the theory is incomplete without specifying what happens to these spectator bosons, even though they are heavy and don't participate in the ultra-low energy physics. Okay, let me talk instead about the theory with NF equals 1, which is asymptotically free. Right? It's not in the conformal, it's not IR-free, so we don't really know what happens at strong coupling. Now, it turns out that this theory is important both in condensed matter physics and in high energy physics, so there's a lot of good reasons to study it. In condensed matter physics, you know, for NF equals 1, the global symmetry is SO2 cross time reversal, which is the same as U1 cross time reversal. So it's physical fermions with U1 cross time reversal. It's a theory of fermions with this symmetry. Now, this, of course, is the theory I started the talk with. It's realized by ordinary electrons, right, with class A3, right? And we know that it's, you know, it's, there's lots of work done on this system, And it's of importance in many other problems in kinetic matter physics. There's a lot of wonderful reasons to study any theory of this of physical fermions with this symmetry, right? And this complicated-looking gauge theory, a joint fermions at nf equals one, and with these heavy scalars, it's a theory that could emerge out of a system of physical electrons with just charge conservation and time reversal. Okay, that's a good reason to study it. Now, it turns out there's another good reason to study it, not from a kinetic matter point of view. This theory turns out to be a deformation of a famous theory in high energy physics, this n equals 2 Seiberg-Witten theory. And some of these other authors were motivated by this connection, I believe, at least Cordova and Dumitrescu. So it's nice papers. So it's perhaps because of these different reasons that it's appeared just in the last 1 year in several papers. Okay, some from high energy and some from kinetic matter physics. Okay, so let's talk about the IR physics of SU2 Yang-Mills with NF equals 1 adjoint fermions. So what we know from prior numerical work is the theory may be conformal. So there's one numerical paper which suggests that it, you know, if it's just strongly first order, then it's not that interesting. But this needs to be revisited, and there are people revisiting it as we speak. So we'll find out exactly what happens from numerics soon. Now, if M is not equal to 0, but very large, then as before, we expect confined symmetry-preserving phases. And in particular, it's easy to check. There's no induced theta term for the dynamical gauge field. So that's why we are confident that you get trivial confined phases. And the question you can ask is there any difference between the large positive M and large negative M gap phases, right? And to answer that question, like before, all we need to do is to calculate the response to background gauge fields. So they could differ by NSPT. NSPT phase of fermions with this particular symmetry, their classification is known. And they're labeled by two integers, K and S, with K running from 0 to 7 and S running from 0 to n. In the gauge theory description, we can calculate the partition function ratio easily without calculating either the numerator or denominator, but the ratio is easy to calculate. And what we know is that it's a member of this class with k odd and s equals 0. Now the precise implement, exactly which value of k is chosen, is determined by the precise time reversal implementation on the heavy bosons, right? If you choose the heavy bosons to be a Cramer's doublet, then it turns out that you get k equals minus 1, which is the standard topological insulator, okay? So then you go from a trivial insulator to the standard topological insulator through some sequence of intermediate phases and perhaps a phase, and certainly at least one phase transition. But anytime we have a route to go from a trivial insulator to a topological insulator in a strongly correlated system, we should explore it and understand what's going on. Right? I think that's enough motivation for us in kinetic matter physics to study this theory. So how should we complete the phase diagram? So the gauge theory description gives us one possible evolution from the trivial to the standard topological insulator. Right? And this is the most standard topological insulator. It's, okay. Now, I already discussed another possible evolution from trivial insulator to topological insulator, which is described within free fermion theory, right? So free fermion theory.
A few minutes.
Just a few minutes? All right, okay.
2 minutes, fine.
I can stop whenever. I'll keep going till you tell me to stop. Naturally, the question arises as to whether the gauge theory and the free fermion descriptions are really just the same. Okay? Now, the two massless theories are the same local operators, and they have almost the same ordinary global symmetries. So a wild thing to dream about is perhaps they are the same theory in the infrared, which would be amazing, right? Some strongly coupled gauge theory in 3 plus 1D, non-supersymmetric, as a free fermion description. So how should we test this wild possibility, right? So there's a zeroth order thing, which is sort of the minimal condition that one should check right? We should at least check that the emergent symmetries and the anomalies match at the massless point. And it's necessary to include both the ordinary zero-form symmetry and the one-form global symmetry that the gauge theory has. And there's several anomalies for these symmetries. There's a chiral anomaly for U1. So let's start by thinking about the emergent symmetries of the massless free Dirac fermion. Okay? So a single Dirac fermion has two Weyl fermions. So the emergent symmetry is U2, it's the group U2. Now, it's known that there are several anomalies for the symmetry group. There's a chiral anomaly for U1. There's the so-called Witten anomaly for SU2, and so on. Okay? Now, in the gauge theory, there are joint fermions. So there's three massless fermions that are then coupled to the SU2 gauge field. Now, it turns out that due to instanton effects, the axial symmetry is reduced from U1 to Z8, but there's still an SU2 symmetry. So the emergent zero-form symmetry is SU2 cross Z8 mode Z2. Okay? So I'm not explaining where this comes from, but it's easy to see. And then in addition, there's Davide's one-form symmetry, the Z2 one-form symmetry. Now, if we compare the free massless Dirac fermion, as far as the zero-form symmetries are concerned, the Z8 is just replaced by U1. Okay? Now, it turns out, and this is actually quite amazing, if you, you know, the anomalies are very easy to calculate. You can calculate them at the UV fixed point. The zero-form symmetries and anomalies can be matched with the free Dirac fermion if we simply assert that the Z8 is dynamically enhanced U1 in the infrared. You know, everything matches. You know, there's many different anomalies, they all match, which is great, right? So the good news is that if the Z8 is enhanced to U1 in the IR, then we can match the anomalies for the zero-form symmetries. Now, there's bad news. It was delivered by Cordova and Dumitrescu in a very nice paper. So there's extra anomalies involving the one-form symmetry. There's a mixed anomaly with Z8, and there's a mixed anomaly with gravity, which have no analog in the free Dirac fermion theory. Okay? So the question is, what's the role of this? So the immediate implication is that this theory cannot just flow to a free massless Dirac fermion. Okay? Even if we supplement this theory by weakly breaking the one-form symmetry with heavy bosons, there's no way that, because the one-form symmetry is emergent in the IR, and this massless Dirac fermion doesn't have such an emergent symmetry. Okay? But it turns out that there may be a way to fix this problem, and that there's a better alternate. You know, the extra symmetries that, extra anomalies that we need to match are those of discrete unitary symmetries, the Z8 and the one-form Z2 symmetry. Now, for zero-form symmetries with discrete unitary symmetries, we know that in high enough dimensions, it's always possible to find a TQFT that matches those anomalies. So we might wonder whether there's such a TQFT that matches the anomalies of this one-form symmetry as well. And we made a guess for such a TQFT. So if you could find such a TQFT, then if you supplement this free Dirac theory with this gap TQFT, then you could potentially match all the anomalies and all the global symmetries of the theory. Now, a specific TQFT that we suggested in our paper is something very simple. It's just a standard fermionic Z2 gauge theory. Right? In three dimensions, three space dimensions, where the electric charge is a fermion. But we regard the loop of this, the flux loop of this theory as a fractionalized loop, meaning if you fuse two such loops, you get a loop which normally in a Z2 gauge theory is trivial, but here we regard it as an unbreakable string which realizes the one-form Z2 symmetry. So this is what we call a loop fractionalized phase. And if we enrich this with the Z8 symmetry in a certain way, we think it might match the anomaly of, we only have a physical understanding of how it might end up matching the anomaly. We await, you know, we hope someone will tell us how to understand what our guess in more formal mathematical terms. Anyway, so the presence of this TQFT means that the phase diagram, once we include the heavy scalar bosons, the phase diagram necessarily has an intermediate phase with Z2 topological order, and that's how you go in the gauge theory description from the trivial insulator to the topological insulator. Okay, so let me just stop here. You can read the summary slides, and thank you.
Running a bit late, maybe time for a quick question.
Is there anything special about the gauge group being SU2?
What happens with higher gauge group?
For fermions, with adjoint matter? We haven't thought about adjoint matter with higher gauge groups. We did think about SU4. It turns out that with SU4, again, you can go between the trivial insulator and the standard topological insulator with SU4 as well. The NF at which that happens probably lies in the confined regime, not in an interesting gapless regime.
Probably means?
Oh, it's small enough NF that we don't know. Right. Now, there is such a there is an IR-free theory for large enough NF, but then that's clearly in a different universality class. That's an example of multiple universality classes for the same phase transition. But clearly, it can be generalized in that direction. We've not done that yet.
The unnecessary phase transition, do you know how to deform the theory to go around?
Yeah, that's a great question. So within the field theory description, what you need to do is to take, for instance, the theory with a higher value of NC, and then deform the theory by adding a Higgs field, right? And then if you condense that in one region of the phase boundary, you keep that Higgs field massive, then in another region you condense it, right? Now,
that inverse phase transition.
Sorry?
That inverse phase transition.
That involves a phase transition along the phase boundary, which is exactly what we have. Right. Now, there's a point of view, again, high energy physicists regard a theory in which you added this extra field as a different theory, but from our point of view, they're all the same theories. Meaning, if you lattice regularized this in some way, right? On the lattice, you can easily, with some interaction, generate what in some IR description becomes an extra field. The theory has the same operator content, everything.
You say there can be a path while keeping finite non-zero gap.
Yes, so, good. So you can ask about the theory of that critical endpoint, right? So that, we don't understand it yet, but it looks very analogous to this phenomenon you might have heard about of symmetric mass generation. Right, which Yizhuang Yu and Chenke and so on have worked on. It looks like an example of that kind of phenomenon, where you go from a massless theory and you generate a mass which doesn't break any symmetries or anything, so everything is symmetric, but there's a critical point associated, and that itself, say in ordinary fermion systems without gauge fields, that symmetric mass generation, there's quite likely a deconfined quantum critical point. That's what Yizhuang and friends argued. Here, of course, we have a gauge version of that. So, yeah, we haven't tried to think about that either.
So the heat capacity and so on would be different right at the end point?
Absolutely, yeah. That's right. That's the expectation.
So maybe here's a good time to stop. Let's thank our morning speakers again.